Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
We're launching a free new Aquinas 101 digital platform. Dive into the world of St. Thomas Aquinas with a customized learning environment, certificates of achievement, interactive elements, and a redesigned digital Summa Theologiae featuring a side-by-side Latin to English translation. To be notified when the platform goes live, sign up at go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. That's go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. Calling all university students, immerse yourself in the ancient and medieval Roman intellectual tradition while living in the Eternal City. Apply now for our Spring 2025 Study Abroad program. The deadline is August 15th and space is limited. Don't miss out. Apply today at ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
So it's a joy to be here. This is my first time in Seattle. Previously, I'd only ever been in the state of Washington for like brief snatches of time because my parents met and married in Portland, Oregon. And so we would come and visit maybe like every 2 or 3 years from the East Coast because my grandparents lived here and aunt and uncles lived here. And so we would bop across the river to Vancouver. But that was, yeah, that was my only experience. So now it's good to be in the heart of what makes Washington a great place. I was talking to some of the students at dinner previously, like, what is it about Washington that's awesome? And we came to general agreement on a number of things. Michael Penix came up for obvious reasons. Again, I'm sorry for your loss. But then also, like, the topography, like, the kind of geography of Washington has a kind of character, which just flying it on the airplane, it's cool. It's sufficiently distinct to shape a people, so I'm excited at the prospect of being here in Washington. But regardless of where you are, and regardless of the geography, human nature remains sufficiently constant as to afford the possibility for universal truths translating. So even though I come from the East Coast, where people talk fast and talk mean in largely ironical terms, to such a devastating degree that you don't actually know if they're serious or kidding most of the time, I think we might be able to connect. I was serious in saying all of that. I think the question of faith presents itself in the modern context as either rational or irrational, depending in large part upon, you know, kind of like who you are and where you're from and what you do. But there are ways in which we can reason with that experience. And so we want to kind of lay the experience out just a little bit and then approach it with a spirit of curiosity, so as to determine whether or not there is common ground to be established. I suspect that many of you believe, and so it's not so much a matter of finding common ground amongst believers as it is finding common ground with many of our modern contemporaries who are almost wholly unsympathetic to claims of faith. So here, you know, Seattle has a reputation for being a very secular city. Again, talking to the students earlier, they're like, I think we are actually number one. So being from Washington, D.C., we're typically in the running for the worst traffic in the United States, which is an equally devastating prospect as the greatest degree of secularity. But I think that there are a lot of good literary examples of those who find themselves confronted by claims of religious belief and then opt out. Certainly the 20th century is filled with those, and in part because of the various traumas of the 20th century and the way in which people kind of registered those traumas and reacted to those traumas. I like the literature of Albert Camus quite a bit. So if you're at all familiar with kind of existentialist or absurdist philosophy, the basic conceit is that you are confronted by various claims. So people say, you know, you got to believe this or you got to believe that. And it's most honest to come before those claims and to remain aloof and to kind of stare back into the absurdity of your experience and then just keep on experiencing, just keep on living. So perhaps you've read the novel The Stranger, and this is the case for the protagonist Meursault. And he shows himself like wholly a stranger from things which would otherwise lay claim to his affections or lay claim to his allegiance or lay claim to his belief. So you encounter him after the death of his mother, and you see in him this kind of dread detachment from life, which manifests itself as a kind of detachment from the other characters, including his lover. And then at the end, you know, you have an attempt by a priest to reconcile him to the faith before, you know, the story ends, in effect. And he rejects it. He rejects it in very stark terms, which I think for religious believers is often an occasion of sadness, but an occasion of reflection, because you see how it doesn't appeal to him and why it doesn't appeal to him. So against the backdrop of such like literary examples or your own experience, perhaps in conversing with some of your contemporaries, with some of your fellow students, I want to propose faith as a more honest and humane and reasonable response to reality. All right. So in order to do so, I'd just like to talk a little bit about faith in the natural sense, and then we'll talk a little bit about faith in the supernatural sense. And then I'll just touch on St. Thomas's approach with the five ways. We're not going to spell out one of those five ways with exacting detail, but we're just kind of going to gesture towards what he's doing and why that matters. Okay, so faith in the natural sense. Aristotle and St. Thomas, the tradition from which or out of which I work, they'll try to be very careful in the way that they use language, insofar as language is a handle whereby we lay hold of concepts which give us access to reality. And so they're careful about the way in which we describe our kind of intellectual access to what comes before us or what stands before us. And so they'll distinguish between or amongst doubt and suspicion and opinion and knowledge and faith. So we have a vague sense as to what all these things mean, but in their more kind of technical descriptions, doubt is when you are caught basically between two kinds of claims and you incline neither to the one nor to the other. You feel yourself hanging in the balance. Whereas then suspicion and opinion is a kind of inclining towards one with a fear that maybe there's some merit to the other. But it seems like the one towards which I'm inclining has, you know, has better reasons or has more merit. And I think that most of our lives are lived at this level, at the level of opinion, because we don't really know what's going on. But on account of the fact that, you know, we're born here to these parents and speak this language and have had this experience, we tend in this direction. And that's fine. You know, that's totally fine. It's not a bad thing to have opinions. It's just how we navigate our experience, what with all of its materiality and contingency and particularity and whatever else. When we talk about knowledge, we're talking about a kind of access to reality that goes by way of causes. Like we actually see how reality hinges and we can identify or articulate how it hinges. And when people say, well, how do you know that? Well, you can point back to the way in which you arrived, not necessarily as a fruit of time or maturation, but as a fruit of deduction or a fruit of demonstration. So a classic example would be syllogistic reasoning. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So in the premises is contained the conclusion. And the process of reasoning is for the purpose of making that manifest or kind of telling that forth. So we try to be scientific in our approach to reality in this way, so as to sift dialectically, you know, what it is that we're experiencing, gather information on the basis of which, right, we have certain premises through which we come to conclusions. So that's what we mean by science in the classical sense, the ancient medieval sense of science. And then we arrive at faith. So faith is a different kind of thing. It's a different kind of claim, but it is not thereby unreasonable. So just like we said, you know, doubt, you're between two positions, and perhaps you haven't had the time or the leisure, or perhaps the things themselves are just obscure. Like you probably feel strongly about the excellence of Washington sports teams. And maybe you have certain rivalries which color your opinion of other members of the Pac-12, rest in peace. But then there are other schools about which you care nothing. It's like somebody might ask you, like, what's better, Arizona or Arizona State? And you're like, who cares, right? That's just so far away, and we rarely play them because they're in their different subdivision. So it's like you probably have something like doubt when it comes to the relative merits of Arizona and Arizona State, right? Because there's just, why? You know, it just doesn't matter. Okay, so that's a totally appropriate response. Your maturation as a human being is not contingent upon you doing all of the work to figure out which school is better. Okay, there is a Dominican campus ministry at Arizona, so it's better. I did it for you. When in doubt, patriotism. And then, you know, opinion, we can make similar types of explanations with these other kinds of knowledge claims. And there's a similar space occupied by faith, because faith is just knowledge, a kind of knowledge or a kind of intellectual access through testimony. And I want to submit to you that it's totally reasonable to live in just this way. You already know this, but it's helpful to set it up as a way by which then to compare supernatural faith. So you might ask, what percentage of our knowledge is verifiable? I don't actually have a number in mind, so you don't have to respond. I think the force of a rhetorical question, though, is typically applied when you afford people the opportunity to think about it, which I didn't. So, but what percentage of our knowledge is verifiable? Not much, okay? Not much, at least not directly or immediately by ourselves, okay? So there's a problem with distance, or there's a problem with size, or there's a problem with access to the appropriate instruments, so there's a problem with competence, there's a problem with expertise. You just don't, I mean, I don't know what an atom looks like. I don't know that anybody knows what an atom looks like. I mean, I just went Bohr model, sounds right, moving on, and never thought about it again from like ninth grade to the present. But I trust that somebody has some sense as to how that goes, and that I can trust those individuals, because why wouldn't I trust them, right? There's a kind of guild mentality with a lot of these knowledge claims, because you got your experts, and they focus on these types of things, and then we trust them, because it gives us access to a reality, whereas if we weren't to trust them, right, we wouldn't have access to that reality. And it seems at the very least helpful, and maybe even beneficial, to have access to that reality. So like maps, for instance. I like maps. I don't know if you like maps. I like maps. But it's nice just to look at a map every once in a while. I draw like great delight from planning trips, in part because I don't do it often, but in part because it's cool just to work out the details of, you know, how you're going to get from A to B. This morning, where did I wake up? I woke up in Menlo Park, California, and then I was trying to get to San Jose, to the airport there, so that I could fly to Seattle. And I just did some quick research, and I found that the Caltrain goes to Santa Clara, and then there's a bus from Santa Clara to San Jose, and I trusted Google, but I didn't look too closely, and I assumed that all Caltrains stop at all stops, when in fact they don't. So this one didn't stop at Santa Clara, so I had to get off at some highway before Santa Clara, and then I would have had to have taken two buses, except that I was on the phone with someone, and generally scatterbrained, and lacking a decent sense of direction. So I went the wrong direction, and then I missed my bus, and then I eventually Ubered. And I upset my Uber driver because he opened his hatch for me and I tried to close it manually. And he's like, doesn't work that way. And I was like, yes, sir. Right, but I have access to the planning of my trajectory, even if I spoiled it, by virtue of the relative competence of Google and Caltrain and then my Uber driver, whose name I've forgotten, but he was driving a Hyundai Ioniq, which is kind of space-agey. Not as space-agey as the Tesla truck, but we'll get there later. You know, like in these things, we trust people, and it's sane to trust people because it facilitates our human lives. It facilitates the living of our human lives. And I would submit to you that it's just part of our human flourishing to believe. Because if we stopped to verify everything, we just wouldn't get too far, right? If before boarding the Caltrain, I had to find a friend who had a mutual acquaintance who knew a Caltrain conductor and could communicate to me with dread certainty whatever schedule, you know, I had to be apprised of, that'd just be exhausting, right? I can just trust that Google, this is an interesting thing to say after the recent AI scandals, but I can trust that Google doesn't want to deceive me too much. So it's part of my human flourishing to believe. And if I try to verify, I trip myself up. You can think about the most basic things in life and how we have to believe them if we are going to proceed. For instance, that your parents are your parents. Prove it. And in saying prove it, you realize in most cases that that's nuts. Yeah, that's nuts. Okay, so there's a certain reasonableness to natural faith because it gives us access to reality in appropriate ways, and it affords us the kind of leisure, the opportunity to engage profitably with the world and with others. So then let's briefly kind of schematize our experience and then pass on to supernatural faith. When we act out of natural faith, basically, we're believing, whatever it is, you know, we're believing that these things are the way that they are, okay? So we're believing that to which we do not have empirical access by our present means. We're believing that these things are as they are described. And we're believing that by human testimony, whether the testimony of an expert or the testimony of a witness or the testimony of whomever. Right, but we're believing somebody in a way that gives us access to the things themselves, and we're believing them because we hold that they are trustworthy or true. All right, so if somebody came up to us and said, hello, I am a political manipulator and I care only for the garnering of votes and nothing else, I might be less inclined to ask that individual as to who the best candidate is in the upcoming local election, because I know that his ends are purely practical. And I don't think that he has any real investment in sorting through the issues, because it's just a mere matter of boosterdom rather than of objective description of facts. So I believe that the witness is true, that his testimony is trustworthy. And my bar for that's relatively low. Maps and Google and other things besides, for the most part, we don't call that into question. The kind of crisis with mass media in the last 25 years has brought out the way in which sometimes discrepancies in trustworthiness or truth can really be destabilizing in a society. I don't know if you've ever watched the news in an intergenerational setting, but it is fascinating to see how people react. Because your grandparents might be like, yes. And then your parents might be like, hmm. And you might be like, what? Right? Because you realize that this pertains to the genre of advertisement. But your parents think that it pertains to the genre of important political contribution, and your grandparents think that it pertains to the genre of truth-telling. Just different kinds of viewing going on there, which is not to, like, cast aspersions. It just reflects our, you know, it reflects our formation. It reflects when we came up and what we were exposed to. So reason is operative in natural faith. Natural faith isn't an abandonment of reason. It's an expression of reason, because we still judge the witness. All right, like we make judgment about the political operator and we make a judgment about the newscaster. We still weigh the testimony. Does it cohere with our experience more broadly? Or is this an outlier? Does this sound strange? Is it a red herring? We also supply our assent, so we choose to believe. There's still a sense in which we, as individuals, as choosing individuals, are engaged by it, but it requires of us a certain response. And then we'll often verify by confirming signs. All right, so if you know, you learn that the best way to get to the Seattle airport from here is to take the 5 South, all right? And if you, in the next time that you take the 5 South, come to discover that you never pass an exit which says Seattle Airport, then you might be like, holy smokes, I should verify the testimony which was rendered to me on this account, or I might be doomed to repeat irrational acts unto ages of ages, which would be horrendous. Okay, so we judge the witness, we weigh the testimony, we supply our assent, and we verify by confirming signs. That sets us up then to think a little bit about supernatural faith, okay? So faith in this setting goes beyond what I have described to this point because it involves a peculiar kind of witness, namely God himself. So the letter to the Hebrews describes faith as the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, or sometimes the evidence of things not seen. So there's the sense with faith, as with natural faith. In the case of supernatural faith, we are describing what is not seen or what is not experienced directly. But whereas with natural faith, there are human beings who have seen it or who have experienced directly, in this case, there aren't, at least on the surface of the earth. Okay? There are in heaven, but not here. So the question then is, how do we bridge our experience with the experience of those who can testify to what they have seen in heaven, all right? So then we can pass to the definition of St. Augustine, who says quite simply that to believe is to think with assent, all right? So to believe is to think with assent. So we supply our assent in believing, we supply our assent to someone. And then St. Thomas defines faith in these terms. He says, faith is a habit of mind whereby eternal life is begun in us, making the intellect assent to what is non-apparent. So which helpfully kind of susses out more of the details of those first two definitions that we just heard. But basically, faith is a habit of mind. There you can hear the language of virtue, a habit which perfects our activity, a habit which perfects our intellectual operation. So it's something that's dignifying, it's something that's humanizing rather than the opposite. Whereby eternal life, all right, so it gives us access to a life beyond, beyond our empirical experience, beyond what we can verify in ordinary human ways, to a life wholly beyond human experience, to a life wholly beyond empirical verification. But it actually comes to dwell in us, right, whereby eternal life comes to take up residence within, and it makes the intellect assent to what is non-apparent. All right, so there's a kind of causal nature to this type of phenomenon, whereby it gives us the wherewithal so as to say yes, and recognizing that that to which we say yes represents for us something crucial, right, something critical, something vital. So when the medievals describe faith, they'll say that there's only one testimony upon which it can be based. That's the testimony of God, right, because only God has access to this reality. He affords that access to those who believe, but it's only God who has access to this reality by nature. All right, now God doesn't have faith, right? He sees himself. But God gives us the wherewithal so as to assent to what he alone beholds in its fullness, what he alone kind of holds dear or holds close. So when St. Thomas will describe supernatural faith, he'll say that we believe on account of first truth speaking. So God, who is true, who is trustworthy, the ancients and medievals will sometimes say, who does not deceive and who cannot be deceived, speaks to us of his life, and he gives us human means whereby to respond. He accommodates that revelation to our recognition and reception so that we can abide by it, so that we can dwell in it. So that's just a basic kind of description. Let's talk a little bit about its reasonableness, and then we can, again, schematize our experience. So you might think, all right, this is a bigger leap to be taken. Certainly, that is decidedly the case. This is a bigger leap to be taken. Because if I am potentially deceived about a train schedule, worst case scenario, I end up taking an Uber ride in a Hyundai Ioniq, okay? Maybe that's not the worst case scenario, but you get it. But if I am deceived, or if one deceives about this prospect, then the stakes are much higher. But you also see, and here you might think of like Pascal's wager in the background, if I opt out, the consequences are potentially disastrous. Sorry, that's not a laughing matter. Okay, so what rides on this? Eternal salvation, life forever, which isn't like a long life and then some, right? It's beyond that entirely. Now, before this proposition, before this proposal, we then can begin to weigh it, or we then can begin to kind of gauge its correspondence. Because there are certain parts of our human experience which would seem to suggest that it must be true. And that's not just wishful thinking, right? That is genuine human correspondence. Because we have an experience at some level of how we transcend this worldly things. And they might be kind of silly examples. Like, if you've ever had a meal, like say Thanksgiving, and you eat so much whatever one eats at Thanksgiving, candied sweet potatoes and cranberry sauce with a nice little ribbing fresh out the thing, or turkey or stuffing or green beans with those crunchy deals that I don't know the name of, and you eat so much that you think, I should never eat again. I will never eat again. I'm going to die a contented man. I'm going to take an eternal nap and hope never to be confronted by the prospect of food. And then 4.5 hours later, you think, but I could have a little snack, you know? we just won't call it a meal. Right? So, all right, crass example, simple example, but in moments where we say, I am content, I am satisfied, that usually lasts for, I don't know, a couple hours. Even in those glorious moments where you're a peer minister at Newman and you have this sweet small group and people are opening up and sharing with you their hopes and dreams and you're like, holy smokes, I have been hoping for this type of connection since I arrived here at school and all I have found is coldness and cool coffee shops. But here we are, we've arrived, right? That lasts for about as long as it takes you to remember that you have an essay due tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. All right, so our satisfaction, our contentedness, it's ephemeral, it's fleeting, it is evanescent. So what are we going to do with that? Are we going to make the judgment that there is nothing in this world which will ultimately satisfy us? Or are we going to make the judgment that we are just doomed from the outset, ill-conceived, ill-made, and destined for frustration? I think that those are both options. I think Merceau, in the kind of introductory description, chooses the former, and that Christians choose the latter. And I think that, you know, many people want to distance themselves from that latter move because it seems like wishful thinking. It seems dishonest. But what I want to try to advance is that it is honest. It's potentially honest, humane, and in fact reasonable. Because who's to say that we should foreclose on our experience, especially as our experience continues to assert itself so vehemently and so vociferously that 4 hours after every meal we think, you know what, forget this intermittent fasting thing. I'm done. And it's time for a great food or great sandwich or whatever else. Okay, so I think that we come before the prospect of religious belief. It invites us to a kind of deeper sincerity. So, all right, we experience need. We experience a kind of infinite inquiry or an infinite longing or a kind of infinite openness to reality. And it's into that space that the Christian claim speaks. And it doesn't say, all right, we're just going to be quietly contented and utterly satisfied, kind of smug, and testify to everyone that we meet that we are beyond happy, so happy, and you should join this happy cult. I just want to say this by way of, you know, side point. You know, as believers, have permission to be sad and to be lonely and to be anxious. You don't have to falsify your experience just because there's something that corresponds. To have it partially is almost a worse suffering than foreclosing on it, right? It's terrible. All right, so you don't have to impress upon everyone that you are happy because you are Christian. I like to impress upon everyone that I'm sad. But again, that's another talk. Okay, so let's schematize our experience. What feature of reality is being described, and then how does faith approach it? We did this with natural faith. Now let's do it briefly with supernatural faith. So not only are we describing that to which we do not have empirical access, we are talking about that to which we cannot have empirical access, at least by our present means. And then what does it give us access to? It gives us access to God. This is an astonishing claim, because the theological virtues, among which faith is numbered, actually give us access to God. And again, the implications of this are pretty profound. So you can get God. You can get God. And also, preachers in the room, you can give God. Right? Think about the best teaching, the best preaching that you have heard. It's not like the preacher or the teacher collated a bunch of cool, trivial facts about God and then pervade them so as to impress you with his erudition. No, he communicated to you a relationship that he has. Maybe he has it beautifully, maybe he has it sub-beautifully, but nonetheless, he's experienced it at some level, and he can actually communicate that. And the words which issue from his humanity bear the revelation of God. And in revealing God, he can mediate God, which is astonishing. So faith gets you God. It doesn't get you cool facts about God. I mean, you get some of that too. Cheers. Right? But faith gets you God. It gets you to God. Not so that you can control him or you can manipulate him or you can submit him to your desire for whatever earthly goods you think will content you here at present. You get God so that you get God. That's it. Again, helpful implication. The only thing that you are promised in Christianity is God. You are not promised anything else. So when somebody says you're going to be happy, when somebody says you're going to have a lot of material goods, when somebody says that you're going to have a lot of confirming signs as to the excellence of this thing, yeah, that might be the case, but it doesn't follow strictly or naturally from getting God. You just get God. And Jesus says, is that enough? And we can spend our whole lives saying, oh, gosh, I don't know what it comes out like, but it usually is somewhere between a whine, a whimper, and a let me take a nap. All right? So by... you know, we can't have empirical access to it, and yet it mediates a relationship with God himself and also affords us access to all things in light of God. So for the Christian, his or her whole experience ought to be kind of basking in the glow of this primary and principal revelation that God is, and that God is good, and that God is provident, right? That he identifies himself most conspicuously as Father for good reason. So faith grants access to that. And we get that by virtue of the fact that God speaks, that in his loving kindness, in his condescension, he reveals, he speaks. So we get it by the divine testimony, by the divine truth, or as revealed by God, as supremely trustworthy, as supremely true. God who is not deceived and who does not deceive. One author says, God, truthful and faithful, speaking and guaranteeing, gives us his word, which all at once is true, and in what it reveals to us of him is both stable and assured in that which it announces and promises. Something that I love about this, I love many things about this, but something that I love about this is the sense of stability or fixity. There's a sense in which, you know, you think about big trees in the Pacific Northwest. I guess redwoods, they plunge their roots pretty far down. I mean, I've heard that sequoias do not, that they kind of interlock or interlace, which is why when you bring down one sequoia, you're basically bringing down the whole grove. It's just a matter of time. But it sounds like redwoods have deeper roots. And you can think about the solidity or the stability of a huge tree which can grow to over 300 feet precisely because it is laid hold of the earth. It intends to grasp, to grip, and never to let go. The Christian lives his or her life kind of upside down with roots plunged in heaven, which lay hold, which grip, which grasp, not because we are strong, but because God has promised to be strong in us, such that we can kind of build our lives in the most meaningful, purposeful, and real of real things or persons, that is to say, God himself. So yes, kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall. Sad times come and sad times go. But regardless of how you feel or regardless of how you think, it matters how you have chosen in light of the gift of God. And that makes you real. That makes you terribly real. sometimes when you encounter a Christian, like somebody who's really alive, it's a little bit frightening. It's like, I can't be cutesy around you. I can't be ironic around you. I can't make stupid jokes or make fun of low-hanging fruit type things, because it just kind of bounces off your adamantine approach to reality. It's like, woof, right? We want that. Not in the sense that we're killjoys or that we thereby destroy all parties to which we are invited, but in the sense that, like, people want to be there because they know that you're fixed, that you're firm, that you're certain, that you're stable. So within this setting, reason is still operative. Reason is still at work. It's not as if you believe and subsequently shut off your mind or shut off your brain. Because within supernatural faith, we're still doing similar things to what we do with natural faith. Evaluating the witness, evaluating the testimony, supplying assent, and verifying by confirming signs. So you think about the judgment with respect to the witness. C.S. Lewis, in Mere Christianity, he has this proposal, either he's a liar, or he's a lunatic, or he's Lord. Jesus is not just a swell fella. That's not an option. Because if you make the claims that he makes and live the life that he lived, that doesn't remain as an option. He's either nuts or devious or who he says he is. All right, so in our lives, we're going to be tempted by like certain desires to explain away because we recognize how very real the Christian claim is and the way in which it lays claim to our fidelity, but to the whole of our life. Right? There's no like, yeah, this part of my life is Christian and this part of my life is not Christian. There's just the whole of your life and it's either all God's or it's not. St. Thomas says, the faith is broken out in propositions. He identifies 12 to 14 propositions in the creed. And he says, say for instance that you hold to 13 of the 14 propositions. Can we say then that you have faith in those propositions and just don't have faith with respect to the one that you have omitted? He says, no. He says, you have pious opinion about those 13 propositions. And you have faithlessness with respect to the last. So either you trust, right? Either you believe or you don't. Because the reason for which we accept the gospel is because God himself speaks and he speaks truly, else there's nothing true. So again, cafeteria Christianity just does not remain as an option for us because we end up making the faith after our own image rather than being made more and more each day to the image of God who has revealed the precise means whereby to be assimilated and conformed unto him. Okay, so we make these kind of judgments with respect to the witness, and we can talk about it in very beautiful and glowing terms. Then we make judgments with respect to the testimony. So we can reason upon what is revealed in faith. We can reason upon propositions of faith. Like St. Thomas Aquinas spent his whole life doing just this, not because he doubted, but because he wanted to find ways in which his love could lay hold of the reality. Again, not to manipulate it, not to control it, but so as to embrace it. Because if you come before something that's so big and amorphous, like how are you going to give it a hug? I think about that bean statue in Chicago. No one's ever given a meaningful hug to the bean thing in Chicago, okay? Or sculpture. Statue is too dignified, right? But if it had handles, then we'd have an easier time. I don't know how that would look. Regardless, right? When something comes before us as kind of seemingly monstrous for its amorphousness, we want ways in which to lay hold. We want ways in which to embrace. And so God articulates the faith so that we can reason upon it and then come to a deeper appreciation of it. So maybe, I mean, you're here, so you're here. But like, maybe some of you have thought like, the intellectual side of the faith, it's not for me, it's just a little too complicated. People get highfalutin and then they craft this jargon so as to exclude those who aren't on the, whatever. Okay, so that happens. It does. It's lamentable, but it does happen. But ultimately, the practice of theology isn't so that we can all be smart, all right? The practice of theology is so that we can love. So that we can find ways in which to articulate our love and that our love can find a home in the God to whom it directs us. So we reason upon the faith and come to discover that it's coherent, that it illumines our human condition. Like, think about how much freedom is attendant upon the revelation of original sin. You might think to yourself, Father Gregory, weird doctrine to identify. But if that weren't doctrinally pronounced by the church, you would probably suspect yourself at every moment of every day of having, you know, impure intentions or mixed motivations of falling short of being inadequate to the call and eventually tending unto something less than heaven, which is a terrible prospect. But we know that at root, we're a little bit bent. And so when in our lives we think and act in bent ways, it shouldn't come as a surprise. It's saddening. It's frustrating. But we can trust that God, with his healing grace, is going to mature us in such a way that we will be unbent and actually shaped after the manner of our Lord Jesus Christ in his time, that he will make us as holy as he makes us. But as to the present, we're still working out the details. So You can have trust that it's a good work and that it will come to fruition. So judging the witness, judging the testimony, supplying assent. We choose. I was talking to somebody recently about, you know, a gentleman who had been Catholic, who had been a seminarian, and who has lost his faith, and is coming before this question in a very stark way. And he was describing how it feels insincere to say that he believes a thing that he no longer believes. And I said, hey, cheers to sincerity, but it's not the most important virtue. And at the end of the day, you can lay claim to a higher sincerity, which is the sincerity of our Lord Jesus Christ. I think being Christian, in part, it involves you in a kind of dopey, overly earnest, and somewhat silly discourse. At least as those things are defined by our 21st century contemporaries. You have to be a little bit credulous, all right, in order to find something credible. You have to be a little bit gullible in order to be taken in by the gospel. All right, and that's fine. The point here isn't to be like so cool that we intimidate all those who come in contact with us. Who gives a rip? You end up sad, lonely, and anxious in a kind of splendid isolation into which no human communion can penetrate. That's nuts, right? But some people choose that. I was recently, I don't often talk to high school students. Maybe I should do this more. It was awesome. I was doing some parish preaching in the Central Valley in Porterville, California. I was preaching a retreat to confirmation students. I would say 65% of whom didn't give the least care in the world about Jesus, the sacramental dispensation, or this upcoming thing. And I was like coming before them and I was like, you have two basic approaches, Gregory. You can either try to convince them that you are cool and that Jesus is cool by association, or you can admit that you are, or you can admit that you are not cool and see what happens. So I was like, I choose the latter, right? So we supply assent, but by supplying assent, we have to step into this space of awkwardness. It's like, I don't know if I'm well equipped for this or if I can do this in a way that people will recognize as, you know, sincere. That just doesn't matter. To be Christian is to be a little bit dopey, a lot bit credulous, but credulous in the right sense, which is to say faithful. So then last, in addition to judging the witness, judging the testimony, supplying assent, we also verify by confirming signs. So in the church's tradition, we talk about two things which help us by kind of reason's approach to give witness to the sensibility or to the reasonability of the faith's revelation. And we refer to these as signs of credibility and then preambles of the faith. So signs of credibility are things that just seem real darn hard to account for unless this Christian faith is true. So like the fulfillment of prophecy, for instance, or the manifest holiness of the saints, or miracles. You look at these things, and yeah, you can walk away from them. Obviously, the Pharisees walked away from plenty of miracles. But when you come up against them, they confront you. They almost assault you and say, what are you going to do about it? Right? What are you going to do about it? And you can present those to your contemporaries, albeit in a kind, generous, and gentle way. But you can say, hey, I've read a lot about the Shroud of Turin, and it's wild. Would you like to talk about it a little bit? And they might say, no. And you might say, okay, I'll try another person. I just so happen to be tabling with Focus this weekend, so party on. So these are the types of things which help point to something supernatural at work within the faith. And then the last is preambles of the faith. So God, in his generosity, reveals more than he needs to. There are certain things that we can discover by the exercise of reason, but on account of the fact that it would take us a long time, we would probably make lots of errors, and only really smart people would ever get there. God says, listen, not like I'll save you the effort, but I care so much about your eternal salvation that I'm going to go overboard and even reveal to you things of a kind of basic nature. So one of these things is the existence of God, right? So God reveals his existence when we can actually reason to his existence. Now, do we need to reason to his existence? No, we don't. It's not necessary because God, again, in his loving kindness, has seen fit to reveal his existence, and we can believe that. But by the exercise of reason, we can come to know it. Not as a way by which to supplant faith or supply for faith's defect, but as a way, again, by which to exercise our minds and our hearts in the pursuit of the truth. So I just want to read you one of the five ways and then give just the slightest description of what it's doing, and then we'll have time for questions. So if you've ever come across St. Thomas Aquinas, you know that he wrote lots of things. The thing that people quote from the most is called the Summa Theologiae, just the summary of theology. You can call it whatever you want, the big book of theology. He starts with a question about methodology. It's kind of like a, what are we doing, boys? And how are we going to get there? Because he's writing for principally for his brothers in the order, for their education in living their religious lives, in equipping them for a certain amount of preaching and teaching, and especially for hearing confessions. And so after that methodology question, he says, we got to prove that the thing is, if we're going to talk about what the thing is. And so, like a good scientist, he proves that the thing is. And that's what question two of the first part of the Summa Theologiae is. And in the final article of it, he gives these five ways to the existence of God. So here's one. The third way is taken from possibility and necessity and runs thus. We find in nature things that are possible to be and not to be, since they are found to be generated and to corrupt, and consequently, they are possible to be and not to be. But it is impossible for these always to exist, for that which is possible not to be at some time is not. Therefore, if everything is possible not to be, then at one time there could have been nothing in existence. Now, if this were true, even now there would be nothing in existence, because that which does not exist only begins to exist by something already existing. Therefore, if at one time nothing was in existence, it would have been impossible for anything to have begun to exist, and thus, even now, nothing would be in existence, which is absurd. Therefore, not all beings are merely possible, but there must exist something the existence of which is necessary. But every necessary thing either has its necessity caused by something the existence of which is necessary, but every necessary thing either has its necessity caused by another or not. Now, it is impossible to go on to infinity in necessary things which have their necessity caused by another, as has been already proved in regard to efficient causes. Therefore, we cannot but postulate the existence of some being having of itself its own necessity and not receiving it from another, but rather causing in others their necessity. This all men speak of as God. Okay, so if you got, let's say, 5 to 10% of that, you're crushing it. All right? If you got 10 to 20% of that, so you should see Brother John Vianney in the back. He's going to want to talk to you about the novitiate, okay? So just kidding. No pressure, but pressure. Just a little bit of pressure. Just kidding. So what's going on here? Basically, St. Thomas Aquinas is looking at reality, and he's looking at reality honestly, okay? He's looking at reality honestly. He's not foreclosing on his experience of reality and saying, all I see is pain and suffering. It's patently absurd. I need to stand astride this absurd reality like Colossus and stare back into the void regardless of whether or not it stares back at me. No, he remains curious. He remains curious, right? He is content to be open to reality, conscious of the fact that to be open to reality means to potentially suffer the wounds of reality. But he knows the stakes, and he's willing to gaze further. He's willing to inquire further, because he believes, at some level, that reality will not so much yield up its riches as speak, and speak intelligibly. And what he encounters in reality is a bunch of stuff, all right? He just sees a bunch of stuff doing stuff-like things. But he recognizes the fact that this stuff can't account for itself adequately. He's kind of going before each thing and saying, how did you get here? And how did you get here? And how did you get here? Because when you inquire after anything in your experience, you realize that it doesn't have a sufficient explanation as to why it is or that it is. Everything that we see here has been made such, right? Everything that we see here has been shaped such by something else or by someone else. And so he says, okay, can we string together a series of causes which, seen from a certain angle, could account for it without introducing some other principle? And he says, no, because at the end of the day, nothing can account for the fact that it is. Nothing supplies its own existence. Nothing can say, yeah, I am this thing and this way and that way for reasons of my own design. Nothing can pull itself up by its own metaphysical bootstraps. It's just not possible. And so St. Thomas goes about looking for ways in which to explain it. And he says, there must be something which exists in itself. There must be something which just is its existence, in which other things here in our experience of reality share or participate. And that they all hinge on that. They all hang from that. And that, he says, we call God. So it's a modest claim, basically that we need to be open to an experience of reality, permit reality to speak so that we can draw from our experience reality sound conclusions. Which conclusions, if lined up, not like easily or overly facilely, but if lined up and treated with care, with attention, will lead us unto their source and their end, whom we call God. So at the end of the day, we visit Meursault back in his prison cell as the priest comes to reconcile him. We often think about the priest, you know, like reconciling him to God, and he rejects that. But we can think about it too as the priest reconciling him to reality. Because we call him the stranger because he has a distance from his life. He's at a distance from his reality. And he will never be close to it. He will never be in communion with it until such time as he is open to it. And when we are open to reality, we come to discover that there is a source and an end. And this we call God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.